Welcome. This is Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 FM here in the high desert of Placitas. And today on Conversations, we are speaking, we'll say officially, with Dr. Victor Acquista. He is an author, amongst obviously some kind of doctor. And there's a presentation at the Anastasi Fields Winery on December 4th. It's 2 to 4 p.m. in the afternoon, all kinds of things going on there, in addition to the presentation by Dr. Acquista. And so that I don't bungle it, let's welcome Victor to the program. Good morning, Victor.
Good morning. Hey. Thank you.
And what will your presentation be on?
Well, I'll be doing a presentation on socially conscious science fiction. This is really a spin-off from a recently published book that came out October 15th. It is an epic science fiction novel and incorporates a lot of social themes. One of my heroes growing up and reading science fiction was Robert Heinlein, and he is well known for incorporating social messaging into his works of science fiction. So I tried to emulate that.
Well, I don't want to further expose my ignorance, but I have heard, as far as sci-fi and socially conscious, that the very short run that the original Star Trek had was just filled with all kinds of social messages.
Oh, absolutely. And Star Trek will have several slides and discussion points in that presentation. Gene Roddenberry, who is the creator of Star Trek, that was one of the ways he chose to challenge some of the social ills that he perceived in society. It's very progressive. When you just look at The Bridge, for instance, with Lieutenant Uhura, who is African-American and an officer on the bridge, really having a lot of status and credibility in that role.
You did not want to get on her bad side.
No. The first interracial kiss, actually, on television, I believe, was the one between William Shatner and Lieutenant Uhura.
To further go further away from talking about your new book, I do remember the old I Spy with Bill Cosby and Robert Culp, that it was a big deal that Bill Cosby could not, like, hug a white actress or much less kiss one.
Right. I remember the show, but I don't remember those prohibitions necessarily. But, you know, that was where we were as a society at the time.
Right. So is there this dominance of non-socially conscious science fiction that we need a group to say, hey, ethical treatment of science fiction writers? Or
well, that's actually a very good question. I think
I get one per interview.
I think that authors and filmmakers as well, which are the two predominant forms that the public gets to experience science fiction in, either something they read or something they see on film or on TV, I think that primarily those are designed for entertainment purposes. You want to have an interesting story with interesting characters that appeals to a wide readership or a wide viewership. I think there are many authors who like to incorporate social themes into their work. And it's a way for readers and viewers to have maybe some perceptions challenged, or give them an opportunity to think about things that maybe could be different, and in some way, maybe socially advance our society. That at least is my intent in right. All the writing that I do, not just science fiction.
Well, we kind of hooked up. We had a short lead time between us becoming aware of each other and the interview today. So I didn't get to speak to a lot of people, but I'd say at least 10 where I'd say I'm going to talk to this guy, wrote a book. It's about socially conscious science fiction, and these people are well better read than I am, and all of them looked at me like, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, so I don't feel bad that I don't know what it is, but it from reading your websites, it's very interesting.
Well, let me just give some examples that I think will illustrate this notion of having socially conscious themes embedded into a story. And we talked a little bit about Star Trek, and those were a series of episodes. But let's look at a well-known book, Fahrenheit 451, by Ray Bradbury.
Right.
Most people probably are unaware of what the significance of that title is, but at Fahrenheit 451 is the temperature at which paper burns, or combusts. Okay. And book burning, and the how knowledge was suppressed or held or accessed within that future society that he portrayed in that book, and it was made into a movie, was something he wanted to call attention to. And that's a social theme. Robert Heinlein, who I particularly am fond of, had a book, a very popular book, called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And in that book, the moon was a penal colony, but it was essentially enslaved to the earth because they grew crops and things which they sent to the earth. They were not really compensated properly for that, and they rebelled. In some ways, it was similar to the American Revolution rebelling against the British Empire.
I mean, if you think tomatoes are expensive now, can you imagine a lunar greenhouse tomato, what that's going to cost?
Well, Heinlein was so way ahead of his time in talking about not only some of these issues, but the settings and the way that he was able to bring light on those issues, but in stories that are very, very entertaining. That particular story is my favorite of his, because the computer on the moon, which essentially runs the whole site, develops consciousness, and is just a very, very colorful character. But that actually segues nicely into another social theme, which we see in a lot of literature and movies. The whole idea of artificial intelligence developing sentience or consciousness, and perhaps having desires and intents different than the creators. You see that in the Terminator series, for instance. You see it in some of the other movies which focus on robots or cybernetic organisms, mm-hmm. or some combination of technology and human that maybe was developed to assist humanity in some servitude or what have you, but then moves beyond that and maybe at cross purposes. So those are just some very common examples from literature. There are many, many others.
If we want to stay with the Star Trek thing, beat it into the ground a little more, the newer series, the character Data, which was cybernetic life. I mean, it wasn't a robot. But it got to the point where the Captain Picard went to the, Starfleet Academy, and he was named a life form.
And this is a common theme, actually, in one of the subgenres, sometimes called cyberpunk, and that is, what defines a human being? Is it the flesh and bones? Is it the consciousness? Is it the decision making and thought processes and values, which in the case of Data were coded into his positronic brain?
Right.
He struggled as a character. That was a common theme in many of those episodes, as to who am I, what am I, and can I develop emotions that are true?
Are they
emotions?
Self-aware?
Self-awareness, yes.
Yeah, because I mean, I have heard people joke about that they're still looking for intelligent life on this planet.
Yeah.
So that's a lifelong task for some people. That's since we never go in a straight line around here, Victor, mentioned sentient. That happens to be part of the name of your book.
That is actually the complete title name of the book. I'll just flesh that out. Some self-promotion over here for the book. The background on this book, if I can
sure.
just
if anyone takes the time to write that many pages or that many words, I think they deserve a little time on our program to tell us about it.
Happy to do that. Happy to oblige.
Good.
I actually had the idea for this story in my head for close to 25 years. Early in my practice, I was a primary care physician. I wondered, well, schizophrenics are purported to have auditory hallucinations, to hear voices. Well, what if that's not, you know, some fanciful thing that we call mental illness? What if that really is happening? Well, why would that happen? And then I had the notion that, well, maybe we're supposed to have full ability to have telepathic communication, you know, among us, both to send out thoughts, receive thoughts, but people who are experiencing these auditory hallucinations are only receiving bits and pieces of thought. Well, if we had a fully telepathic society, it would probably be very peaceful because everyone would be tuned into what's going on with everyone else. There probably wouldn't be hunger and violence and poverty. And
would we grow up as a civilization with this, or we would, like, one day everyone would develop it?
Okay, well, in the book Sentient, our parent species was that way, but the actual full telepathic capacity doesn't develop till puberty. And the notion that I had with Sentient was that our parent civilization was wiped out by a telepathic warrior race that used mind battle, the so-called mind warriors of Trox, that's the alien planet, whose intent is to be the supreme sentient race in the galaxy, so they find other races and conquer them. They're a conquering species. They pretty much commit genocide on our home world, but we manage to
see... Without laying a finger on us.
Correct. All with mental battle. Sort of like that old movie, I don't remember the name of it, but it was all with mind battle and the heads explode.
I know, I had an old girlfriend like that. It was not pretty.
I can relate to that. In any case, we establish a colony, and the colony is on Earth, and we genetically alter our genome to prevent the emergence of telepathy, to avoid being found by this alien conquering species until we could repopulate a whole planet. And the schizophrenics are individuals who have an incomplete genetic block, and so that they do get thought fragments from this collective unconsciousness. And it's mischaracterized as mental illness. And in the book, that is a theme that is explored, really how we treat people with mental illness. I would say that's a relatively minor social theme. The main theme has to do with separation and isolation from one another, and how that leads to unhealthy competition. A lot of the book has to do with imagining what it would like to have a society that was a collective, but not like the Borg collective. You know, there isn't an individuality in the Borg collective, but the kind of collective that I envision in Sentient is one where each individual has a unique set of talents and abilities that they contribute to the collective to make the collective that much more interesting.
And everyone in the collective is equal.
Oh, yeah, yes.
So this is like Imperial China.
I don't know much about Imperial China.
Well, me neither, but I thought it sounded good. Well, just that because everyone served the emperor. There were obviously all kinds of different skill sets and different social strata, but still that old saying, the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. I'll go off into another area I'm unqualified to talk about, you know, World War II history. I thought, you know, part of the challenge that the Allied powers had was that the Japanese, who were so loyal to their emperor, they were going to fight till they died. It was like an old Monty Python movie where at first you lose a leg and then the knight is bouncing around on just a torso. They didn't want to get captured. They wanted to fight to the death, not a mentality we could grasp, which gets back to your book. Is this about the United States civilization or Western Europe or the whole planet?
Well, you can certainly draw parallels to the...
Was it even close on any of that other stuff?
Well, yeah, actually, there are a couple of things you mentioned that are very relevant to the book. The Japanese samurai, and that society was largely clan-based. Not that there was a single emperor, but you had your feudal lord or what have you that you answered to. But there were rules to follow, and honor was very important to maintain honor. And this is one of the important elements in this alien society, which is a clan-based society. They have loyalties first to themselves, where they want to be having the highest status as an individual within their clan. Then to their clan, they want their clan to be rated the highest and the superior among other competing clans, and then their entire civilization. As I mentioned, they're driven to be the superior sentient race in the galaxy. Well, they have a very, very dysfunctional government because there are six operating clans. There is a seventh, and I'll get to that in a moment. The six operating clans are allied three against three, and the leader of the entire Supreme Council is essentially powerless to get anything done because the three on one side always ally and balance against the three on the other side. Now, the seventh clan is the so-called outcast clan, and this is one of the major plot elements in the book that requires resolution. The first element is our loss of telepathic capacity due to the genetic engineering. That's the main plot element. But the second is the disgrace of Clan Zukan, because they do something that is dishonorable in the conquest of our homeworld. The name for our homeworld is Aiden. So in the conquest of Aiden, the Clan Zukan does something which essentially gets them kicked out of the council. And for many, many eons of time, they are considered to be the outcast clan. And in the book, that plays out with one of the main characters who's trying to restore honor and dignity to his clan.
I don't know if you get into this in the book, but since you write about this stuff, you might have an opinion. The telepathy.
Yes.
If they said next Tuesday we're all going to be telepathic, I think the world would be dead by the end of the day because everybody would know all the things that they're too polite to say. So I think you'd have to kind of grow into telepathy instead of turning on a light switch. But is it a more complete form of communication? You know, I can't really, I'm not criticizing, I'm observing, you know, people who speak more than one language. The language that was not their native language that they probably learned later in life, they can communicate much better in English than I can in their language, but they don't have the expansive vocabulary of a longtime bilingual person. So you get the idea from them, but you know it's not as well said as William F. Buckley would have said. Is that true of telepathy also, that it's a much more complete communication, or it's broken English kind of communication?
Well, I think for purposes of the book and on our home world, it was a complete shared and readily accessible. In some ways, you can think of the World Wide Web as being a database, a repository of information where we could look things up. But if you took that to an extreme where I could access not only knowledge but the thought processes and the emotions behind that knowledge, I could determine the truth or falsity of that knowledge, and we all have that shared knowledge base, that's the kind of telepathy that I'm talking about, but without losing our individuality. So I'm not sure
if that answers your
question or not.
Well, that it's way beyond my little pea brain to grasp. Because, I mean, how do we truly grasp telepathy. But so you, even though that you, little Victor Acquista, started his life in Brooklyn, New York, you became a New Englander.
That's correct.
You had lobster and the garlic.
Yes, sometimes my Brooklyn accent comes out. Sometimes my New England accent comes out because I went to school in upstate New York. I went to college at Cornell University, and that was the last time I really lived in Brooklyn. After college, I went to a medical school at the University of Vermont and then stayed in New England. I did my internship and residency at the University of Massachusetts, and then fellowship training in Rhode Island. Eventually moved back to Massachusetts after I practiced in Rhode Island for a few years, and moved back to Massachusetts and continued primary care practice there.
So your initial higher education was at Cornell?
Correct.
Ithaca?
Yes.
Is it true that Ithaca has better pizza than downtown New York City?
Well, most of my New York City experiences were in Brooklyn, and I will vouch for thin crust Brooklyn pizza, and I haven't found that duplicated anywhere.
And a good.
I hope I'm not offending anyone.
Well, they're used to it. and a good potato knish in Brooklyn.
Yes, yes.
That's hard to find any place else.
Yes.
So, all right, and at some point, you came to New Mexico.
Yes. Well, I should say that writing and speaking is really my third career. My first career was as a primary care physician, and then I...
And you weren't a hobby writer at that time, or...?
I had played around with things really for my own amusement, nothing that I submitted for publication, some short stories, this kind of a thing. But I segued into administrative medicine, became a medical director, worked closely with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in and around the care for the developmentally disabled. I was really working in an administrative and clinical capacity as the medical director for a fairly large facility caring for adults with developmental disabilities. Now, many of those problems that we encounter in caring for developmentally disabled adults are not that different from caring for seniors in long-term care setting, particularly with dementing illnesses. So I underwent some additional training in senior care and a little bit of geriatrics training and developed expertise in the long-term care administration. I was doing consulting work in different parts of the country for facilities that were experiencing difficulty providing medical services. And there was a facility of this type in New Mexico, down in the southern part of the state near Silver City, Fort Baird, that had been decertified by CMS. The state was under suit by the Department of Justice for quality issues related to providing care to the population there. And I took a job with the New Mexico Department of Health to come and try and improve care delivery at Fort Baird. I was one of several people who were involved in this effort, and we were quite successful. But that's how I landed in New Mexico. I spent 5 years in Silver City.
That just conjures up all kinds of tangential questions for me, but I'm going to take this opportunity to let everybody know that you are listening to Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 on the FM dial from Placitas, New Mexico, and we're having a conversation today with Dr. Victor Acquista about his new book, amongst other things, Sentient, which, depending on when you listen to this, will be December 4th at the Anastasi Winery, 2 to 4 p.m. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. So we're going to continue our conversation with Victor, Dr. Acquista. You came out to New Mexico through the Department of Health.
Correct.
You're living in New England, you know, East Coast mentality, East Coast weather, some of the bad East Coast weather. Had you ever been out here? Did you have family that went, hun, dad, whatever, what are we doing?
Well, I had met my lifetime quota for shoveling snow. But we had no ties, neither my wife nor myself, to New Mexico or this part of the world. My only visit to the Southwest was to Lost Wages, Nevada. But we looked on it as an adventure. My wife's mother and father had traveled across the country after they had retired, and their visit to New Mexico, when they came back, they told my wife that that's where your people are, that's where you have to go. And we looked on it as an adventure to come and see what it would be like, and we liked it very much. In fact, after finishing up with the Department of Health a couple of years ago, we moved up to the north part of Rio Rancho and have been very, very happy with that move.
It's amazing because we have an opportunity through the program to speak to people. It's like speed dating in a way. You get all the way into their life in 45 minutes that would take months or years if you just see people twice a year at a holiday party or something. This migration from the Northeast, or just the East, you know, from the Mason-Dixon North, where you would go, these people are Florida bound for one reason or another. That's our people, their people. Yet, more than I can count on one handful, people from that place of origin, a family member came out here and said, you all need to come out. This is where you belong. Them never having been there, it's very fascinating to me. So the same thing happened to you.
Yep. We had the call to the land of enchantment, and here we are.
And how long has it been?
Well, we moved to the Silver City area back in 2009 and spent a little over 5 years working with the Department of Health at Fort Baird, and came up here just over 2 years
right.
ago.
So at what point do you go, this medicine stuff is not for me? Well, you actually kind of said that early when you went into administrative medicine. It's medicine, but it's...
Right, well...
It's like the guy who works on the car versus the guy who's sitting in the boardroom.
I think, for me personally, I really enjoyed being a primary care doctor, and there are many exciting challenges and privileges, really, with being a part of someone's personal lives and addressing their health care needs.
You're an extended family member.
In many respects, yes. But after doing that for 15 years or so, I was feeling I needed to embrace new challenges. And that's really how I got involved in the administrative aspect of things. And in some way, there's a parallel. Rather than caring for sick individuals, you wind up caring or focusing your talents and skills on improving the health of an organization or a system. And after doing that for a number of years, I said, this is really exciting. I feel I've accomplished a lot, but I'm wanting to do something that's been put on the back burner for a while that I've not really had the time or energy to devote to, and that was writing. I had written a book, a self-help book, during the time that I was still actively practicing and working full-time, but I had this idea for this science fiction novel, and I reached a point where I said, hey, if I'm going to do it, I need to do it.
I'm going to just explode with curiosity if I don't find out the name of that self-help book.
Oh, sure.
Organizing Buttons by Dr. Victor Acquista.
Would you like to see the cover of it?
Sure. Just happened
there
to
you go. It's called Pathways to Health, an integral guidebook. It uses something called integral theory, which is pioneered by an American philosopher named Ken Wilber. Some of your listeners and viewers might be familiar with his body of work. It's a very interesting way of looking at the world. it can be applied towards medicine and healthcare, and that's how I used it in my book.
So you've moved into career 1.2, which is the administrative side, and you're getting ready to make that jump to become a full-time author.
Well, right. I made the jump actually a couple of years ago, and this first book, Pathways to Health, was actually picked up for translation of all things Danish, and that's because there's an institution called the ID Academy, the Integral Dynamic Academy, in Denmark, and they are proponents of integral theory, and they've translated a number of books. But then I went on to get some foreign rights deals for distribution in India and Nigeria and Pakistan and other parts of the world. In fact, the international sales for this book have been a little bit better than the domestic sales.
India, Pakistan, I thought they grew up with this. They know how to balance your chi and your zen. And
well, there is a lot of experience.
Not to be broad brushstrokes.
There's a lot of experience in the East with some of these meditative practices, some of these practices to manipulate subtle energies, and that knowledge is used in their healthcare systems. Ayurvedic is really the predominant healthcare model or approach that I'm familiar with in India.
Well, so to write something like this, doesn't the AMA put a hit out on you? Or
no, not at all, because and this is the beauty of integral theory. There is a tension or conflict between what is a loose conglomeration of alternative health practices and then mainstream medicine. Mainstream medicine, Western medicine, allopathic medicine uses a scientific method. It has its origins in modernity as a philosophical approach, and it relies on the scientific method and is very, very sound. There's nothing in this book that contradicts Western medicine. These alternative practices may be less scientifically rigorous, but that doesn't mean they don't have value or truths embodied in those approaches. And so without getting overly philosophical, but there's a German philosopher named Hegel who looked at many things in terms of a dialectic, which is a thesis and an antithesis. So in this case, we have the thesis of Western medicine, which is highly reductionistic. It takes a set of signs and symptoms of illness and distills that into a diagnosis, and then we treat that diagnosis. So the thesis there is a reductionistic approach to care. The antithesis of that is a holistic approach to care, which is really looking more like at the forest than at the single tree in the forest. So you get that dynamic there between two opposing ways of looking at the world, a holistic way and a reductionistic way. Well, integral says, no, those things don't have to be in opposition. We have truths that are embodied in that reductionistic approach. We have truths that are embodied in that holistic approach. So let's look at the synthesis. And this is what Hegel really was very brilliant at, is saying there's a way of looking at this from a perspective that's sort of above, that transcends and includes the two other perspectives. And that's really what the integral approach is. And it applies not just to medicine, but it's been used as a way of looking at law, politics, education, ecology, pretty much any discipline that you can think of. You can look at that through the integral lens and sometimes look at what appear to be contradictory approaches and say, well, gee, you know, if we go past this thesis antithesis to a synthesis and look at it in an integral way, then we can understand it at a higher level.
As far as the pathways to health, on the part of the book where you address health, is it more prevention than Western medicine?
What I think the strength of this book is it spells out a conceptual framework for health that is much broader and more inclusive, because not only does it include mind, body, and spiritual aspects of health, but it includes the environment, and in this case I'm talking about the social and cultural environment. Your economic status is a major determinant of your health outcomes over time. So that's a social issue. You grow up in a neighborhood that's infected with drugs and crime and violence and, you know, people getting shot on the corner. Well, that has an impact on your health. That's a social thing. There are cultural aspects to health, such as what are your values, what are your belief systems, what are your dietary preferences. If you're a meat and potatoes kind of person, that's a cultural aspect to what you eat. If you're more of a beans and taco kind of person, well, that's another cultural element. So when we look at health in this broad conceptual way, and then there's a series of assessments in the book for people to look at aspects of their lives that really relate to mind, body, spirit, environment, and then using the results of that assessment, you actually make a map of your health, an actual representative map of your health that says this is where I am, point A, and then point B is where I'd like to be, and then there's a series of action steps that you commit to. That's sort of a way to behaviorally contract with yourself. But I'd like to just mention one or a couple of other things about this book. There are chapters in here which relate to things that people don't normally think of in the context of their health. And I'll just use one example, forgiveness. If you go see your primary care doctor, I don't think you expect them to be addressing how forgiveness might need to play a role in your life. But in fact, studies on forgiveness...
Or prayer.
Prayer is another example. Well, we under-train in Western medicine in the spiritual aspects of health. And I'm going to just loosely lump prayer into that.
Okay.
But just returning to forgiveness, studies on forgiveness have shown that people who are trained, because we can train you in becoming better at forgiveness, people who are trained in forgiveness have less stress, higher self-esteem, less chronic pain, and a host of other health benefits. So wouldn't it be curious to go see your doctor with a variety of complaints? Maybe your blood pressure is too high, you're feeling stressed, you're not sleeping well, your back is hurting you all the time, and the prescription included forgiveness. That would be wonderful, because there actually are proven benefits to that, but we're not trained in that way. So
And there's no billing code for it.
There's no billing code for it, not that I'm aware of. And just as a little side thing to mention, studies in forgiveness have also shown increased work productivity, at least in a group of managers.
Is this me forgiving you or me accepting your apology that I forgive you?
Well, forgiveness is a self-choice, and it could be forgiving yourself. It could be forgiving other people for transgressions or hurts that they've been responsible for, that you've been on the receiving end.
Something horrible like cutting me off in traffic that I carry around for hours.
Well, that's probably unhealthy. That example is used in the book, being cut off in traffic and being angry and carrying that around. But
I mention it because I attempt to never ever do that. And if someone does it to me, it's like I figured they're in a real hurry. There's a reason that they're doing that. It's not just because they're horrible human beings. But if I do it accidentally and I'll see the reactions as if I, chopped up their newborn, it's like, really? You think maybe you're overreacting a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good approach. And you don't know what the other circumstances for that person are. And, you know, I don't think you willfully and intentionally, cut someone off. But there's a lot of misunderstanding when it comes to forgiveness. There's some common myths. One is that someone needs to apologize to the person that they've hurt in order to be forgiven. Well, that's essentially very disempowering, because it's putting the power of forgiveness into the hands of the transgressor,
right?
Rather than holding that power within yourself, because it's your choice whether to forgive someone or not, irrespective of whether they apologize or not. Another common myth is that to forgive and forget. And I just use same example I used in the book. If you touch a hot stove and you get burned, that's how you learn. Something bad happened, you learn. You don't want to forget that, because chances are you'll do it again. Well, when someone hurts you, you have to learn from that experience, and not forget it, not write it off as though it never happened, because that's not a good recipe for preventing it from happening in the future.
Do you, in the whole 18 seconds that I've come to learn about this whole concept, Victor,
yes.
Is it possible that it's easier to do with people rather than with yourself? You know, I can forgive you for taking my parking space. I don't, but do I need to tell you about it?
Well, I think that you raise a good point. For some people, self-forgiveness is easy. Okay, I fell short of the mark. I screwed up somehow. I'm going to try and do better in the future.
I should never have dropped out of law school. Yeah. I'm too old now. I can't go back. My life would have been so much better if I just hadn't, followed the Rolling Stones around for 3 years or something.
So you beat yourself up for years and years and years about something that happened in the past that you can't change, and that's not very healthy. Some people find it difficult to forgive themselves. In my particular case, that's my best place to practice. I'm falling short of the mark every day in some way, shape, or form.
Or do we set the mark too high?
Well, you see, that has to do with your values and your judgments and a lot of cultural aspects to your upbringing and your thought processes about yourself.
So how does a trained physician, administrative or medical administrator for a big organization, international speaker and author, how do you learn this stuff, that part of what you're going to be speaking about on December 4th at the winery, 2 to 4 p.m.?
Well, on the winery, we'll be talking about socially conscious science fiction.
Okay.
But there are training courses in forgiveness. I do workshops that include, I do two different workshops on forgiveness, basic techniques and advanced techniques. These skills are imminently teachable. It's unfortunate that we don't teach some of these life skills really more broadly through the educational process. I would much rather have learned about forgiveness when I was in high school than trigonometry. I haven't had much use for trigonometry, but
because of your career.
Well, perhaps
I used it a lot.
Okay,
but I get your point.
Well, I the series of workshops I do are called the Life Skills Workshop Series. We don't talk about balancing your checkbook there, but we do talk about things like stress management. And I think that's another life skill that should
be. Financial issues are number one stressor in a relationship.
Correct.
Or lack of finances, probably.
Well, that's true. So there are many life skills that I don't think we do a good job educating people around, which could improve the quality of their lives, which ultimately, to me, is an aspect of health. The word health has roots that include whole and holy. So those all stem from the same word roots, language roots, holy, whole, healthy. So if we could have ways of helping people to feel more whole and more holy, we're at the same time are helping them right. to feel more healthy.
That seems like a multi-generational issue to me, because I mean, I don't know if it's just the people I hear about or associate with. All of them know, should eat better, should exercise more, should get better sleep, maybe drink less. If they smoke, don't smoke. Manage your blood pressure and your diabetes. Everybody knows that. And some do it a whole lot better than others, but a lot of people in the society, I mean, we wouldn't have all these pills stuff if we knew that. So where are you saying target the young and re-educate us all?
Well, my wife is a K through 5 teacher. I mean, you can start young and incorporate these things really throughout the educational process. We can begin talking to children on the playground who get into fights about managing conflict in relationships. You do it at a level that they can understand. But I think that as we go up the level in our educational system, the opportunity to really examine relationships and conflict in relationships and so on is there and can be, it doesn't have to be a course in psychology, it can just be a course in life skills.
Right. But it's also all the other things that we know we should do. You know, I used to travel a fair amount for work, and you'd go by the gym in the hotel, and there are 10, 12 people in there at 6 a.m. doing their thing. And I'm going, I should too, but I don't. So what's right with them, or what's wrong with me?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because I think I have a good answer.
Good.
Not what's wrong with you, but you said that you have a knowledge that certain things are healthy, or certain things that you can do, behaviors, exercise, eat right, not smoke, and so on, that are healthy behaviors. But having that knowledge is not sufficient to actually incorporate those behaviors into your life. And that really gets to the issue of motivation. What motivates us to do anything? Well, we have intrinsic or internal motivators and extrinsic or external motivators. So let me give you an example. Let's say you smoke, and you know that that's not good for you, but you continue to smoke. Well, an internal motivator for you might be, hey, I want to set a good example for my children. I know smoking is not the kind of example I want to set, so I'm going to work hard to stop smoking. Or I want to be around as long as I can to, be a good father or a good mother to my children, so I'm going to stop smoking to live longer. That's an internal motivator for you. Or I don't want to spend all this money on cigarettes. That's an internal motivator. An extrinsic motivator, maybe your spouse is after you every time you light up a cigarette.
Sure.
They're coming after you and ragging on you and telling you, stop doing that, you shouldn't be doing that. And after a while you say, my gosh, I'm motivated to stop because I can't listen to that anymore.
Well, there are other ways of solving that problem, Victor. I think it depends on what the bad behavior is. You mentioned we learned that the stove is hot by touching it, and we don't ever do that again. You have that first fast food burger, and it's wonderful, and you could do 20 years of it, whether you started at the age of 15 or the age of 50, and you may not see an effect. Same with smoking. It's not a cigarette makes you sick. Like,
right.
So we're wonderful forgetters. We keep making the same mistakes over and over again.
Well, I don't think it's so much that we're forgetting. It's that there's a time displacement or a temporal displacement between cause and effect there. When you touch the hot stove, it's pretty immediate.
Oh, yeah.
And so you get a negative feedback on that. When you are enjoying that fast food, and let's face it, there's an enjoyment factor with that, which complicates it because you're reinforcing something that feels good or is pleasurable and so on and so forth. And you're not at that moment having any bad outcome. But the cumulative effect over time can be detrimental. Maybe you develop atherosclerosis, or maybe you develop an obesity problem, and there are health consequences from the decisions that you made and were cumulative over many, many years. And that's a particular challenge in having people adopt healthy behaviors, because sometimes the benefits of saying, okay, I'm not going to eat that. Well, that doesn't feel very good. I really want that. I had a bad day at work. I want that half a pint of chocolate ice cream right now.
Yeah. We're in the middle. My wife and I are in the middle of. We're in like week four of no cheese, no flour, and it's horrible. Quitting smoking cigarettes was easier. I even Googled vegan cheese. Maybe it's a petroleum product, that it's not a dairy product. It's torturous, but I know it's better for me, because I could not teach myself that a wedge of brie is not a portion. Mm. That's supposed to last more than a day.
Right.
I don't know how. Doctor, tell me, what do I do?
Well, what do you do? I was fond in practice of telling my patients that a long life of self-denial is probably no better than a short life of self-indulgence. So I pulled a Benjamin Franklin and said, all things in moderation. So, I think that people have to find that balance point between what the quality of their day-to-day life is going to be with the health decisions that they make, and develop a comfort level based on knowledge as to how they want to make those decisions and what they want to do. And it's different for each individual.
Some people find it so easy. There's people out jogging every day, or the people that go to gyms. But gym memberships, we see them, come January, you can't get in there. And by February, it's empty. But we actually, believe it or not, have used up our time. But I did want to at least mention one of the other things that I think it's worth looking into more about, Dr. Victor Acquista, the integral theory, which they can find out a lot more about on victoracquista.com. It's really another place most people haven't gone that like sci-fi and thinking.
Yeah, I don't have a lot on my website addressing integral theory. That's my main website. I have some things. I have a secondary website called pathstohealth.info. But if you just Google integral theory or Ken Wilber, there are so many resources that are readily available if you're interested in learning more
and
about that.
And how's Sentient doing? It's received well?
Sentient has just been out just over a month, came out, or just under a month, actually, October 15th. And we've gotten fantastic reviews. It's doing quite well so far.
Thank you. Appreciate your time today. He will be at the Anastasi Winery on December 4th from 2 to 4 p.m. And this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 FM in Placidus. Thank you.